And we never left. And we never left, baby.
I think there's just a direct line between our brains at this point. There is.
It's amazing these mics are able to pick up what they pick up. I mean, we do this show telepathically almost every day. But I was telling you before we got on, I was like, you're going to need to strap in. The reason I'm saying that is because I was starting to freak myself out. Because I mostly started this research a few days ago, but then I really leaned into like the full-on deep dive of it just last night. I was very, very unsettled. So as a DC girl, I can only imagine this is going to be quite the trip for you.
I was going to say, you are wrong for this. You're like, and it's right in your backyard.
Okay, but to be fair, I did kind of warn you of this because we talked about this case when I was talking about, we mentioned this to each other a couple of weeks ago when we were looking at like, oh, we should do a case where I can come to DC and I can like be with you and like we'll go on location.
Yeah.
This was one of the cases I was talking about. So I think what freaked me out about it was that it's this notion of like anything can happen in a split second. That's what really scares me about a lot of these cases. It's like something where you just saw somebody. It's like somebody you love, somebody you know, sibling, a friend. They're walking and then they're gone. And nobody can explain it. So I will say this is an unsolved case. And it involves the abduction of at least 6 known young women and girls. And nobody has ever been able to identify the man who's behind it because he only ever went by the alias The Freeway Phantom. Do you remember this?
I remember us texting about this, yes.
Did you read a little bit into it, or was it just like the base, like the headline?
I think I clicked the article just to see where it took place in DC. And I think if I remember correctly, it was Northwest or Northeast.
There's a few different locations. But the thing about the Freeway Phantom is that the media had actually coined the name because he developed a pattern, which I'm going to talk about in the top line, but he developed a pattern of leaving his bodies at freeway ramps.
That's disgusting.
Well, let me get a bit further into this. So, like I said, while we were looking at DC cases, we had stumbled across this, and I didn't get too far into the story. So I was like, oh, maybe this might be interesting if I could do a deep dive. And of course, it's a case from the 70s, but Jesus Christ, is it terrifying. For a top line, for anybody who's like me, who maybe wasn't familiar. Also, hi, creepers. Welcome back.
Hi, creepers.
Hi, creepers. So this case, the case of the Freeway Phantom, it traces all the way back to 1971 when there was sort of like a crisis going on in DC. There were a string of serial abductions and murders, 5 young girls and 1 woman that were all identified and connected back to one potential unknown killer. All of the girls were abducted and they were killed. They were all young Black girls. So this started to develop a theory that this was a crime of people being targeted by race. But then we also had confirmation from a note that was allegedly left with one of the bodies where it was confirmed that this killer had a particular disdain towards women and young girls. He was seeking them out to do this. So these girls would go missing off the street in a split second, and then their bodies would be discovered left and positioned at the freeway exits surrounding DC, which, as mentioned before, gave way to the nickname the Freeway Phantom, an unknown man left on the loose. And there are lots of reasons that this case remained unsolved and still remains unsolved to this day, namely because of the shocking lack of press coverage at the time. But specifically, we would come to learn there was quite a bit of resistance from police who were virtually absent for the entirety of the investigation, unwilling to help, mostly because these were young Black children who were being killed. So for decades, their stories were kind of not even just swept under the rug, but as we would learn later, the records were purged. Files were destroyed on this case. So for a very long time, I think probably before People Investigates covered the story, much, much later on, decades later, nobody remembered this story. So today, we are going to relive some of what the horror was in D.C. between 1971 to 1972 and hopefully take one step closer in trying to figure out who the Freeway Phantom was. Because it's still very possible, I did the math of this last night, it is still very possible, based on the profile that they had sort of examined and what the FBI came up with later on, this person could still be alive. How you doing?
Oh, God. The first thing I started to envision, honest to God, were Black mothers having to tell their kids, like just being on high alert, like, and how terrifying that must have been. Just knowing that you weren't receiving, you know, like, support, I guess, from what you're telling me, and just
none,
having
virtually
to,
none,
and knowing how fast little kids were disappearing, just like that, what a awful reality to have been living in for that year or 2 years.
Well, I think it was like 14 months in total, maybe a little bit more, but I think you might have more of like a geographical knowledge of this, but I think in 1971, segregation in the city was still very much a real thing. And this community, this neighborhood, was on the other side of a river, which in turn was part of the reason that they were so separated from any sort of police control to come in and do searches or look for whoever the culprit was. So what happened was a lot of this community was kind of banding together, and they were going out on foot to search for people. They were going out on foot to, like, protect people. They had no resources. You would learn in a lot of these cases, like, police never even came out. Like, missing children, police never even came to the scene.
That's so sad.
So we are going to jump into all of it. But before we do, before we go through the absolute hell of this story, let's just say welcome back. Let's take a break. Let's take a breather. I'll take a swig, a sip and a swig.
I'll take a swig. Mm.
Welcome back, everybody. We missed you guys. I just want to say, before we get into any of this, a huge thank you on behalf of Stu and I to all of the creepers, because we have been watching you online. You don't think we do, but we watch you, babies. Everybody who has shared this show with someone in your life who you are close with, or with other people online, because you have no idea how helpful that has been, because we have a huge new wave of listeners who have just joined the show, who are now listening regularly, and it is solely because of you. So thank you for everything you do, all the appreciation you have for the podcast, all the word of mouth, the positive reviews every time you follow. I know that we preach this all the time, but so many of you really do take it to heart, and you really do follow that, and you have no idea how much it helps the show. So this is our moment of gratitude, just to say we love you, we appreciate you, and just thank you.
Yes, thank you, creepers. We love you guys. We were just talking about before we started recording how wonderful it will be, like, just to continue to build this community, and y'all are the best. We love you guys so much.
They really are. I know I say this all the time, but I feel like I know them. I really do. Do you feel like that?
Yeah, no, 100%.
It feels like a ritual thing now, where we just, like, hang out every Friday and we just kind of shoot the shit and we talk about these stories. And I will also say, for all of the new listeners who are just here, welcome. We do have a staggering number of Gen Z in there, which you and I have talked about. Spotify always tells us that we have an unusually high percentage of Gen Z in the audience. I think more than any other true crime podcast they've got in the partnerships program is what we've been told. And you and I know that true crime tends to resonate a little bit older. It's more so like millennial, Gen X, who follows true crime. Boomer audiences are in there as well. But Gen Z is a bit of a new one. So welcome to all of the Gen Z listeners. We're happy you're here. It must be our radiance and our youth that is emanating from these mics.
Well, I was going to say, that's a hard bag to get to get Gen Z to, like, a couple of two old millennial hacks.
There's just no other. What are you talking about, baby? People are going to start asking me if I'm Gen Alpha.
I honestly, like, in my everyday life, now that I know that creepers, a lot of them are Gen Z, I'm like, was that Chugi? Like, about things I do, which I think is inherently Chugi.
Even to wonder if something's Chugi, it's too late, baby. It's already Chugi. Yeah. But I mean, I'm telling you, we radiate youth. Spotify is going to start carding us. They're going to say, excuse me, we don't employ child actors. What are you doing on the show?
It's the sunscreen.
Stop, please. It's the Elf sunscreen. Not sponsored, but I wish it was.
I know.
If anyone's got to connect, hit us up. But we'll hold on to all that for another day. Thank you again to everybody for stopping by. And with that, I am ready to get into the story. Are you ready, Stu?
I'm ready.
Okay. I'm telling you, this is going to be especially weird for you because you live in DC. I feel the anxiety for you.
I know. I'm going to try not to be so like heavy with it because I want to, but it does. I did, when you started to talk about it, I just immediately felt like a, ooh, like it, cause it's right here. It's,
I feel that when people talk about LA, like when people talk about the Night Stalker to me, I get worked up.
Yeah.
Because I live in a ground floor apartment. Like the thought of, I can't even get into it. I'm going to freak myself out. No. I've only got a few more hours of daylight. I'm going to freak myself out bad. So let's first set the scene of where we're at. The year is 1971 in Washington, D.C. So everything about the communities in D.C. at the time, I was kind of, you know, like I said, I was doing my deep dive because I really wanted to understand what was the area like at this time. It seemed very divided. Segregation, as I said, was still very much a horrific reality. There were a lot of Black Americans who were living in D.C. who were pushed off to the fringes in sort of the impoverished areas surrounding the core of the city. And tensions were running especially high because this was 1971. So Dr. King was assassinated in 68. And following that, there were a lot of protests. There were riots. So there was a lot of like an uptick in policing around the city and an uptick in racial discrimination. But also, this is smack dab in the middle of protests going on in D.C. because of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. So it's there's a lot of contention going on in the city. But from what I was reading, in sort of these like siloed neighborhoods, there was a strong sense of community. So that's kind of where this will all start. People feeling safe in this particular neighborhood, this borough, people feeling like they knew their neighbors. Everything seemed fine. Until this one day, where they realize there is a real-life monster who is lurking the streets of D.C. So we're first going to take a look at the beginning of his reign. This is April 25th, 1971, and we're going to focus in on 13-year-old Carol Spinks. I do have pictures of all of this. Again, I'm going to post all of this up on Reddit. It'll be on Facebook, so anybody who wants to follow through the story and actually see images of the area, of the scene, of the girls, those will be available. Now, Carol, she lived in a DC apartment with her mother and her siblings. I think she had quite a few of them. I think her mother was a mother of seven children in total, or she might have been the eighth, unsure. Now, at the time, she had specific instructions from her mom because her mom was away in Maryland visiting a friend in an apartment. But the instructions were, while I'm gone, do not leave the house. Don't leave the apartment. Carol broke the rule. So Carol, like I said, she had a lot of siblings, and I think they were just being kids, and they were bored, and they wanted snacks. So one of them, I think her older sister, was like, Carol, you should go run down to 7-Eleven. I'll give you some money, pick up some frozen meals, grab some sodas, etc. So Carol was instructed to do so, and she did. So she left her home on foot that night, 13 years old. She walked along the sidewalk on the southern side of D.C. when suddenly she collided with her own mother. Her mom was basically on her way back early, so she came face to face with her mom, and her mom was pissed, but she was kind of like, once she explained like what she's doing, she's like, we were bored, like we wanted to grab snacks and stuff. I didn't mean to break the rule. Her mom was kind of like, okay, go to 7-Eleven because it's three blocks away, grab the snacks, finish what you came out here to do, and then come straight back to the apartment. It's just a few blocks away. What we know happened is that Carol then went into the 7-Eleven. The clerk saw her. People saw her. She got all her purchases. She ended up picking up bread. She got sodas. She picked up frozen dinners for her siblings with the money. She checked out with the intention to head straight home. She never made it back. Within just 1 hour of Carol not returning, the entire family started to feel the panic that something was very wrong here. So her elder sister, actually the one who had instructed her to go out and get that stuff, she went out to retrace her steps. She walked all the way to 7-Eleven. She talked to the clerk. Everything checked out. They were like, we saw her. She came in. She bought all this stuff. Carol just somehow went missing, even though she was just a few blocks from home. So her mother immediately panics and she called the police to report her 13-year-old daughter as a missing child. County police come in with this bullshit. They tell this woman, she's 13, she probably ran away. And they tell her explicitly on the phone, we're not going to send out any help. There is no cruiser that is ever dispatched to the home. There is no officer that ever comes to look through the neighborhood for Carol. They basically just told this mom, like 7 or 8, like, good luck, lady, you're on your own. Mm. Could you imagine that?
No, and it's especially heartbreaking because she just saw her.
I know.
So like any law enforcement in their right mind would be like, wait, you just were with her and now she's gone? Like, she didn't run away. That's very clearly not a runaway situation. She had a nice interaction with her mother.
Exactly. Like there's, I mean, even if it was a runaway situation, it's a 13-year-old girl out in a major city on foot in the middle of the night. Like, send a cruiser. It's just, it was insane to me reading that. So beyond the fury of the sheer panic, the sole resource that is designed to help you in this situation basically tells you to get lost on the phone. And then they just hang up the phone. They drop the call on her. So this mother, she doesn't even know what to do. She just starts to panic. She starts calling her friends, begging them to come over and help look for her on the street. There is a child on the street somewhere. Something is wrong here. So everyone kind of assembled and, you know, they kind of start plowing through the neighborhood that night. There is no trace of Carol. They don't even find the bags, the groceries. Police never budge. They never came over. They wouldn't end up getting involved until 6 damn days after her disappearance.
Oh my gosh.
And the only reason they were involved is because something disturbing is found. On May 1st, near the grassy area behind a hospital on the southeastern side of DC, there were a group of kids who were kind of playing in this like grassy back area when one of them spotted something down an embankment off of the highway. It stopped them dead in their tracks. Laying at the base of this embankment, facing straight up, eyes open, was the small, thin body of a young black girl with cuts all over her neck, arms, hands, and face. Carol Spinks. So these kids, they basically ran as fast as they could. They were able to flag down a Metro police officer, and backup was called, where they inspected and later positively identified the girl as 13-year-old Carol, last seen 6 days ago. And a cruiser had still not been out. Beyond the deep cuts around the body, it was very clear that she had been violently strangled. There was already significant bruising and damage around the neck. And once the body was examined further during an autopsy, it was further concluded that Carol had been dead for somewhere between 2 to 3 days. And she also showed signs of sexual assault. So these findings led investigators to believe that Carol was absolutely abducted the night of the 25th. She was most likely held captive for several days. Then she was assaulted, and then she was brutally murdered and then dumped right off of the freeway. This would mark the very first known killing of the Freeway Phantom. Let's just unpack a little bit of that. How are you doing? I know what kills, it's so preventable. Like, it was shockingly preventable.
I've literally been saying in my head, you know, don't be angry and like just be level-headed about it, because like really what I would like to do is come out of this with a better idea of like the profile of who this person would be and not be angry at like, you know, what could have and should have happened. Of course, like we should feel those things, but if this person is still out there, my God, like we need to figure out who the heck would do this. Like, I'm thinking to myself, is this opportunistic? Like, she was just at the 7-Eleven and someone saw her. Like, so I'm sure you're going to unveil that with the rest of the profiles that and how it kind of goes down. But
no, that's kind of a common theme, actually. I was thinking the same thing as you, though. I'm like, is this opportunistic? Like, how, because I mean, in theory, like, how long could she have been stalked, I guess? Because nobody would know that she's going to go out that night unless they had been watching her for weeks. Had they been watching her at school? Like, there are so many questions, but we would learn with most of these cases at face value, they look opportunistic. And in fact, what's even more chilling about it, they even look consensual, as if like a lot of these girls got into the car willingly.
Mm-hmm.
It's uncertain. I mean, there's no real way to know, but there are a few clues that led us to believe that. So I'll keep going. What happens next is that this makes huge waves in the community. Things like this did not happen. And despite that, despite like a lot of people being terrified, it was not picked up by the media. But this is a really shocking event. I mean, this is a child who was murdered, and there's somebody who's out there on the loose. The news is not covering the story. The bulk of that had to do with racism, point blank, because local outlets were cited as having predominantly white viewership, so they did not want to cover the crimes that were inflicted against a young Black girl. So effectively, this kind of buried the story for a while and actually, I think, damaged the case and allowed it to go on for as long as it did. But this is a homicide case, so it does get assigned within the DC unit. It is taken over by 28-year-old Romaine Jenkins. She was the first woman who ever became a DC homicide detective at the time. So she's young, she's ambitious, and she is handed this egregious murder case. It's a mystery, and it's in a neighborhood she's never even been in. But she is dead set on trying to figure this out. So she was ready to take this on full time. But she's kind of locking horns at the time with her department, and specifically, I think, her sergeant, like her supervisor, because nobody within this department gave this any weight but her. I mean, she's basically a solo effort, and there are protests that are going on because of Vietnam in DC, so all of her instructions coming from the top down are saying, we need like amped up policing in the streets of DC because there are protesters, it's unsafe. So she never even gets a chance to go out to the neighborhood to start interviewing people, and she's the only person on this case. It's just like such a distant problem within the unit that it's several months where it's almost completely forgotten. Nobody goes out to investigate this until 2 months later, after Carol's murder, another abduction would take place in the same neighborhood. This is July 8th, 1971. So this victim, her name was Darlenia Johnson. She left her home where she lived with her mother, and I think she was going to her shift at work. However, that evening, she would never be seen again. No one reported her making it to work that night, so I think that's where the first line of suspicion came from. They were like, that's unlike her to just blow off work and not show up, and no call, no show. And then she never even made it back home. So her mother immediately feared the worst, knowing 2 months prior what just happened to this girl, Carol Spinks. So she reported her daughter, just 16 at the time, as a missing person to police, a missing minor. And again, another mother met with the same resistance from police who refused to come out and help. But what really chilled her was that over the next couple of days, in fact, past a week, she received several disturbing phone calls. She started to routinely get these calls on her home phone, which she would pick up, and she would hear the voice of a man breathing heavily into the phone, saying nothing. She knew in the pit of her stomach that whoever this was on the phone, this was absolutely the same guy who was connected to Carol Spinks' murder. And whoever this guy was, he had her daughter. Still, even so, no help from police. She's being terrorized by whoever this guy is. So, of course, I mean, the calls come in. She reports it straight back to the police. They couldn't trace calls in 1971. So whoever's on the other end of the line, total mystery. This would continue for 7 straight days. It's a daily ritualistic torture, really. I mean, it's a torturous phone call to this desperate mother because she wants to answer in case there's some sort of clue or there's an instruction or a ransom, something. And all she gets every single time is just this heavy breathing until after a week, she gets one call and the man finally speaks. He says, I just killed your daughter. And then hangs up the phone. It was only days later, on the 19th of July, when a call came into DC police to report the discovery of yet another body. Positioned and propped up on the side of the I-295 freeway was a heavily decomposed corpse of a young Black woman, Darlenia Johnson, identified via fingerprints. Now, at this point, the person who responded to this call, and actually, I think the first person who saw the body, this was Sergeant Charles Baden. He took a deeper look into this area, and he sort of remembered the rumblings of just a couple of months prior about Carol Spinks. There was another girl who was found in DC, another young Black female. you could not imagine the horror when he actually looked at her file and saw that Carol's body and Darlenia's body were found just 15 feet away from where they were each found. That's a serial killer.
What?
A serial killer who has a pattern of dumping these bodies in the same location.
Oh my God. That's really, so I already knew. I was like, this is a sick, sick individual that they're calling. Cause then they're basically getting themselves ready for the kill and enjoying the dangling of the carrot to, like, they're getting some sort of high off of it.
A lot of the profile, so foul. It's so, so wretched. What the FBI, when they eventually put together their loose profile of this, they do think he's a psychopath, whoever it was. Yeah. And he needs things like this to stimulate his brain, to make him feel what he can't feel otherwise. He needs to see people go through agony. He needs to see people go through intense fear in order to feel something himself.
Mm-hmm.
So before they can even dive into the homicide investigation and look into the possible connection, because they were like, wait a second, Carol Spinks found 15 feet away from this girl, Darlenia. Before they even have a chance to do that, another girl has gone missing. This was 8 days later after Darlenia is found. This is July 27th. Brenda Crockett, just 10 years old, never came back home after heading out at 8 p.m. to go grab groceries at the local supermarket. So this happened. Her mother, again, another parent who immediately starts to panic. She went out herself because at this point, I mean, word had traveled that the police aren't doing anything. And she said, I have to go out immediately to look for Brenda with her sister. So I think, or sorry, she went to go look for Brenda while her sister stayed home. While her sister's home, the phone rings. 9:20 p.m. Her little sister picked up the phone and she said, hello. What she hears is Brenda's voice. Now, the recollection of this call is a bit confusing because I think she was pretty young at the time. I mean, Brenda was 10 years old, so this girl had to be around like 7 or 8. But what was clear is that Brenda was crying, she was confused, and she said, I was picked up by a white man. And he said that he's going to send me home in a taxi. Somehow this call ends, but then a call comes straight back to the home, and this time the stepdad answers the phone in a panic, and he says, Brenda? It's Brenda again. She's distraught, and she's even more confused, and she starts kind of rambling, and she says, I'm being held in Virginia. Did my mom see me? And then the stepdad says, I don't know what you mean. Like, what do you mean? Did your mom see you? Like, see you where? She then whispers, I have to go. Goodbye. This is the last time anybody hears from 10-year-old Brenda again. How are you doing? I hear you sipping on something.
Oh my God. It's my Sprite. You know, I've got my Sprite next to me.
A comfort Sprite. I understand.
The comfort Sprite. I just cannot believe that. I really didn't think this was going to take a turn where they were like a total sicko. Like, I honestly thought that it was going to be, I mean, obviously they're a total sicko because they're serial killer, but like, I didn't think they were going to have this level of
the game, psychopath. The cat and mouse. Yeah,
the cat and mouse, like very Zodiac-esque, and it's very, very disturbing.
Did the Zodiac come, when was the Zodiac, the 60s?
60s.
60, okay, so Zodiac came first. I mean, because
this, well, and 70s, but late 60s.
Yeah, because this person does start to do some Zodiac-like things. They become aware that they are getting coverage in the press eventually, and they kind of seem to get off on that, and they also start leaving notes, right? They leave things behind. So mm-hmm. I almost wonder if there was a bit of inspiration there. But this is the most interesting part of the story thus far when I was reading it, because we've got this call directly from Brenda saying, I was picked up in a car by a white man and he took me to Virginia. He's going to send me home in a taxi. So we're getting a few different details of, like, it sounds like there's a little bit of manipulation there. If she thinks she's going to be sent home in a taxi and this was like a good doer who was just picking her up off the street, but she's clearly distraught and she's nervous. But the most interesting detail is saying it was a white man who picked me up and that she's being held in Virginia. Two very specific details that you would think an abductor would not allow her to say on a phone. Mm-hmm. So this gave way to another theory that these were deliberate seeds that were being planted to throw the scent off. So like I said, this phone call would be the absolute last word they ever hear from 10-year-old Brenda. And mind you, we have zero effort from the police at this point. This is still going on. We've got three minors who've been abducted and killed. Because as we would learn, Brenda's body was found by the following morning, placed and positioned along Route 50 highway near Maryland. So according to the report from the first responders on the scene, after she was discovered, there were clear signs that she had been strangled to death and she was raped. So there's a pattern between the three girls at this point, that there's trauma to the neck and there's always sexual assault. Now, at this point, we've got these three girls. They have been murdered. There is no lead, but there is this consistent through line of the concerted efforts to terrorize the family. It's clear he's getting off on doing what he's doing. It's becoming a part of, it's a bit like his tool. You know what I mean? Like he abducts and kills these girls, but his way to sort of seek the effect that he's looking for is to call the family, and it's untraceable. They can't find him. So investigators, they started to wonder if the calls that Brenda were allowed to make, as I said, were deliberate attempts to throw the scent off. In other words, was she being fed these lies to share with her family over the phone to plant the seed of doubt? Somehow, she had access to a phone, so we would have to assume that it was probably set up by her abductor. Otherwise, she would have broken away from him and she had secretly made a phone call. And if so, maybe she would have called the police. It's uncertain, but she was very adamant, saying it was a white man who picked me up and I was taken to Virginia. But investigators then believed that both of those clues were direct lies. The murders did not slow down, because just 2 months after that, we get a fourth victim who is claimed by the phantom killer. Her name was Nina Misha Yates. She was a 12-year-old girl, also a young Black female, consistent with the description of the three previous victims. She, very similar to the others, was headed out on a grocery trip. She was going to a Safeway to pick up a few items. She had her list. She had sugar she had to get. She had to pick up flour. She also had to grab paper plates for her family dinner. But the difference in her disappearance was just how quickly she was found, which might indicate that something went wrong in the abduction. It's believed that the evening that she was abducted, before she ever even made it to the Safeway, and then just 2 hours later from her vanishing, a local teenager stumbled upon the body on the side of the road. In his witness statement, this teenager described the body as still warm. Again, first responders, they came there, they found her. She was placed on the side of the road, visible markings that she had been strangled and she had been raped. A fourth girl was claimed. So what we can say is that this has been going on since April. We're nearly at the fall at this point. There are four dead girls in DC. Police don't have a singular lead in this case. They don't know how it's happening, who's doing it, and it's not national news. These are like any other part of the country. If these were white kids, this would be national news. A serial killer who's targeting children. That's insane. And this would mark the first serial killer ever recorded in DC history.
I'm just praying to God that you tell me that the next, that after this killing, they finally get their act together, because the fact that he's starting to mess up, because clearly something happened where he wasn't able to like execute on the, you know, getting her back, calling the parents, doing his whole sicko
the
thing.
Whole, yeah, he would usually
like,
keep them in confinement.
This is the time.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this is the time to like, well, first of all, the time was back in April, but this is the time. Like, this guy is starting to mess up. And also, he's got a clear pattern of like being A, obviously in this neighborhood, but circling like convenience stores or grocery stores, or like he knows that's how he gets these little girls.
Exactly. There's a consistency in it that you would think, okay, we could have people stationed near a convenience store or a grocery store. Like, these are obvious things. It was just so far in the back of people's minds. Nobody was paying attention to the story. But what I will say is that at this point, after the fourth victim, finally, the local press, they picked up the story, because technically this was a serial killer. That's a very big story in DC history. It's shocking. Now, what the local newspapers had coined was the freeway phantom. That came directly from their headlines. But he wasn't done. He wanted more girls. So at this point in the case, the city and this community, they are furious because over the last 6 months, we've got four dead girls. As I mentioned, police have not done jack shit in this investigation. Families are literally, Stu, the families were investigating this themselves because they had no help. They're going out on foot with family friends in the areas where their daughters were found, looking for evidence to pick up just in case someday police want to take an interest in this. Like, these people have been completely abandoned by the one force that's supposed to be solving this.
So many levels. It's
horrible. And also, could you imagine the fear of, like, living in this community, knowing that this community is getting targeted by this, repeatedly targeted?
Yeah. Well, that's what I, at the beginning, that was my very first thought, is that it's already awful when you feel like you don't have anybody to call for help, but then the reality sets in where every day it could happen to your daughter.
A few blocks down the street to school or to a store, and it could be over. It's that quick. But of course, you were kind of right, though, because after the fourth victim, this is when the police kind of start to get their act together, but they realize what they're dealing with is much bigger than what they can handle. So they go in and they tap the FBI. This would be a turning point in the story. So this is a chance of, or an opportunity where county is sort of passing the baton to say, we can't handle it. We haven't been looking at this case closely. We don't really know. We don't have the resources. So they pass it over to the FBI. And one important detail that I want to call out just before we get into what the FBI does here is that DNA testing was not yet available. But the FBI, they do know the importance of consistent DNA-like evidence, such as hairs. So that is what they hunt for. They go back and they review all of the evidence, anything that's left in storage, pictures of the bodies. What they found were that three of the girls had the same consistent type of hair that was found in their underwear or underwear region. They were able to determine that this hair came from a male, and it was connected to most likely coming from the same and singular male, which they were able to deduce was most likely a black male based on the hair. So it's a black man who is targeting just black girls. But while the FBI is digging into evidence over a period of weeks and they're trying to catch up on the case, another girl is claimed. This is November 16th of the same year, Stu. The fifth victim of the Freeway Phantom was abducted and found in Cheverly, Maryland. So there is a bit of a variety in the places that he's dropping the bodies at this point. It's strange because some things in his pattern seem really consistent, and then some things are very inconsistent. He changes up his tactic. For specifics, this body was positioned at the access ramp to the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, which is, I think, on the northern side of I-295. This girl was actually the only adult girl who would fall into the mix. She was 18-year-old Brenda Woodard. Again, another young black female victim to match the pattern of the abductor. According to the timeline the FBI was able to put together, Brenda was seen just the night before because she was attending a night class, and then she went out with a friend to grab some food. She then later took the late bus home. Sometime after she got off that bus, it's believed that she was ripped right off of the street, very similar to the girls before. Brenda was then raped. She was strangled to death, and her body was posed and left off the freeway. But what disturbed the FBI, despite the obvious connection to the Phantom, was that Brenda had also been violently stabbed. So to them, this indicated that there was an increased likelihood that the Phantom was becoming more and more interested in mutilating his victims. He was getting more violent the longer time went on to see what else he could get away with. But I will say that this murder is a bit different because the Phantom left something with the body. Something to be found. Inside of her coat pocket was a handwritten note penned from the killer himself. So the note read as follows. This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you catch me, if you can. Signed, the Freeway Phantom. But here's the horror of that note. The FBI, they would end up doing a handwriting analysis of the note. It was not penned by the Phantom. It was penned by Brenda herself. She was made to write the very note that would be placed beside her dead body by the following morning, as if she's a pawn in the game.
Oh my God.
So chilling. So there are two things here, two things that I really want to focus on with that note. He is very much locked into the news story, very much like the Zodiac Killer. He is following mm-hmm. what his alias is, what people are calling him. He's following that there's a chase going on and that he's elusive and possibly alluding to other victims too. I will name the others when you catch me, if you can. Are there other girls who hadn't even been connected to this case yet? How many has this guy killed? So the other thing that I would say about that note is when they were doing the handwriting analysis, what was very confusing for the FBI is that it was her handwriting. But typically when you're being forced to write a note, if you're a victim, your handwriting is a bit shaky, kind of scratchy. Hers was very, very smooth. Very calm when she wrote that note, which started to make them think, could this be a person that she knew, that she was familiar with? Why would she be so calm? You know, I mean, there are lots of reasons that we can pull that apart and try to figure out, you know, why that was, but that was something they noted. And they're like, this is unusual. Typically, if a victim is being made to write a note that will be found with their body, they're shaking pretty bad. But the FBI, they're at a loss. They have virtually no lead, but they have this collection of clues, which would suggest they are dealing with a black suspect and possibly a local, as he's a repeat offender in this area. But like I said, his tactics are getting more and more varied. They're a bit different from girl to girl. There are some times that he's making the phone calls, sometimes that he doesn't make the phone call. Sometimes they're held for days, like even up to like a week. Sometimes they're just held for hours or something goes wrong. So there's an inconsistency to his profile that kept him pretty elusive. And it's very possible this was deliberately part of his plan, because whoever this is, he is smart enough to remain invisible in plain sight. Nobody can catch his trail.
Is immediately interesting is that certainly it seems like the two older girls were killed much swifter than
that's a good point.
I think that his thing is that when he picks up these girls, depending on their age and their personality, he doesn't really know what he's going to get. So when he gets somebody that's going to be more, a little girl that's going to be docile and isn't going to put up a fight.
Or easy to manipulate.
Manipulate. He can do his little psycho games. But then when he picks up an older girl, it's weird when you were saying she was calm writing it, because I was wondering, was she calm because she was like, okay, she's old enough and with it enough to think, if I remain calm, maybe I can get myself out of it. And maybe she even put up a fight at some point, and that's why she was mutilated so badly.
That's very possible. I think that the stabbing definitely could have indicated that she fought back, but she definitely knew, she must have been scared, because she definitely knew who she was dealing with. To be writing that note and mm-hmm. then at the very end of the note to say, signed, the Freeway Phantom, mm-hmm. she would be absolutely aware of who the Freeway Phantom was at this point.
Yeah.
And she would know that none of his victims have gotten out of it alive. It's a death sentence. There's lots of, I mean, we could like mull over this forever and talk about like, why would she have been calm? Was it possible she knew him? How local is this guy? I mean, sometimes the direction that you don't look is right in front of you when you're looking for somebody, especially if it's somebody mm-hmm. who you don't suspect. From the language he uses and the way that he's smart enough to evade police, it might even suggest that he works a normal job. He might blend in pretty well. Nobody would suspect that he has psychopathic tendencies. Like, it could be anybody. It could literally be anyone in the city.
I also just keep thinking about the way that DC is sort of laid out, that his like scattering almost of these different bodies. DC is kind of interesting in that like it's very easy to offshoot into like Maryland or Virginia, mm-hmm. like depending on where you go. So I wonder if he was just like, he would drive around, and then when he couldn't find anybody that he felt like was opportunistic in DC, he would just kind of like pop over to Maryland or pop over to Virginia. And then that's kind of why naturally he was always near the freeway.
So do you think that they were getting into the car willingly? Do you think he was kind of manipulative or persuasive enough to be like, oh, you look like you you got a long walk ahead of you. Like, do you mind if I give you a ride? I'm just heading up this way.
That was my first thought, was that he was like, let me give you a ride or something. And actually, it
especially
was
with the
weird
little girls. I mean, that would, yes, that would work so easily, I could imagine.
So easily, especially if they're carrying a bunch of groceries, exactly, and if he's like really, yes, forceful and he's like, oh my goodness, like, don't you carry those groceries? Like, let me help you. Where do you live? I live right in the neighborhood too. Like, I could totally see that
absolutely
going on.
Absolutely. I mean, isn't that a, I think that's a common tendency of people who present with like psychopathic tendencies, is that they're very good at like socially manipulating people. They front really well.
Right.
Really well. So I can totally see that. I actually wonder, I think maybe one of the only instances of an abduction gone wrong might have been the girl who was found 2 hours after her abduction. I think that was probably, mm-hmm, someone who tried to fight back, and then it became a panic moment of he was just trying to get rid of her body as quick as he could.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens next? We've got 6 months. Everything basically goes quiet. So nobody hears about the freeway phantom. Nobody gets abducted. Like, everything is kind of, it's settled. So people wanted to believe that this like reign of terror was over. Whoever the freeway phantom was, he somehow just vanished himself. Maybe he finally felt like the FBI was just getting a little too close for comfort, or they were like getting close to him, figuring out who he was. Maybe he left town. They just did not know what happened. But that was not the case. It's like the second you let your guard down, that's when they're back. So just when enough time had passed that everybody had kind of relaxed, people were allowing their kids to go out again, they could walk to the store, the phantom claimed another girl. September 5th. I believe it's September 5th. Did I say November before? Could be a bit wrong. Either September or December. Maybe that's a typo on my part. Sorry if that's a typo. But it was September 5th, 1972.
I was gonna say, it might have been the next year.
It might have been the next year. Yeah, sorry, that confused me.
It's funny because when you started to trip over yourself, I was like, I bet you anything it's the next year, because I feel like that's how these killers operate. Zodiac did the exact same thing.
They like move in like waves of season.
Yeah, well, they move in the waves of season, and then they also, I think when there's too much happening, where they feel like they're starting to lose their own like ability to make it all go, they like take a break so that they don't blow their own cover.
Exactly. I think you're right. So this was September 5th then, 1972, when the phantom claimed his last known victim, Diane Williams. So she boarded a bus home after, I think she had a date night with her boyfriend, and her boyfriend walked her to the bus. It was a late bus. He watched her get on. She got on and then finally got to her stop. When she got off at her stop, something happened on the side of the road without anyone seeing. She was ripped right off the street. And then by the next morning, again, Diane was found positioned right on I-295. Yet another duplicate murder of a young Black female with evidence she was strangled and raped before she was positioned on the freeway. So at this point, the FBI, they're back on the scene. They are terrified that the phantom is back and that he's hunting for new girls. So between the local police and I think the absence of results from the FBI, which, I mean, if the FBI can't crack something locally like this, it's just, where do you even go from there? It was crazy, but this is when local amateur sleuths actually jumped in on the case. They started trying to crack down on who it could have been. Who was the phantom? Now, a lot of the same clues that were looked at before, I think the sleuths were looking into again because they wanted to try to find consistencies. Like, what is the through line with all of these girls? There are obvious things, but there has to be something more in the back of his mind as to why he goes after this particular target. So they looked at the consistencies of locations for the abductions, and I even read a theory. I think this was sometime in like late 1972 where one of the sleuths noticed a connection between three of the girls. All three of them shared the same middle name, Denise. It's not clear. Weird. Yeah, it's not clear if that was ever connected to anything, if it was substantial or valuable to the case, but it was an odd connection between all three of them. And in fact, it was so odd that I think the press at the time picked it up and they were like, he's going after Denise's. Like, could you, if you had a middle name, Denise, you were next kind of thing. So this kind of pressure from even the local amateurs is what reignites the FBI to re-examine basically everything from top to bottom. They had no idea where to go. They started to look at what was left on the bodies and what had been kind of scooped away into evidence. And what they found were carpet fibers, the same type of fibers found on 5 out of the 6 girls. That is our consistent through line. It was a green synthetic carpet fiber, possibly from inside a car.
Definitely.
This could be like, this could be the smoking gun, right? That could unravel all of it. But even with this detail, kind of narrowing the hunt, that doesn't really lead to anything. I mean, what could they possibly do? Like, just do like random searches of everybody's car in DC, everybody who fits the profile. But that was the only thing they had to go off of, the only additional clue they could find, because there was nothing else that could lash this onto anybody. There's no witnesses. There's nobody who saw the abductions, nobody who heard a scream. That's menacing.
I mean, it was the 70s, so I'm sure there was actually a lot of green carpeting in cars. But I mean, damn, if that's your one through line, I would have been, if I were an investigator, I would have been circling every Safeway or convenience store looking in cars for creepy looking cars with green carpet. And maybe that sounds really, you know, like trivial, but I mean, what else do they have to go off of? And I guess nobody else was doing anything.
This is kind of the most devastating part about this, because it really is a dead end, because after this, the Phantom never struck again. So something happened to him, or he left the DC area because he thought they were getting too close to him. And this was shuffled away into a cold case file. The families of these 6 different girls were completely left without answers. So that is where the case is left. It is unsolved even to this day, but there are a few serious suspects to consider here that I will talk about with you. But I just want to, after going through all of that, which I know was a lot to sit through, thank you, Creepers, for listening to it as well. How do you feel as a DC resident? How does all of this sort of land?
I mean, it's just, like I said before, it's just weird to think about. I feel like I've told you this, that in DC, one of the craziest things to me are the people that drive here. Mm. Like, it's a really, and it really might be the way it's laid out, that everybody kind of zips in and out of the city because they're going to Maryland, they're going to Virginia, they're going back to home base. And the drive, so it is, as you've been talking about it, weird for me to think about, assuming that it was still like that back in the 70s, but like, it's a city at the end of the day. It is fast paced. Like, he really could have been just like snatching these girls up. And it just is really unnerving to me to think about that he would then just kind of zip right out of the city and then dump them off the side of a freeway. Cause I can see that in my like mind.
Yeah. In your minds. I know what I almost wonder like which state he did live in. He could have been from out of the state and was coming in just like this was his way of remaining elusive, because you come in middle of the night, do what you're going to do, and then drop them off, and then nobody sees you again. You're not even in like the same jurisdiction for questioning. Like, that's a way that he probably evaded things for quite a long
time. Totally.
There are a few, so I'll get into a few of like the potential suspects and avenues here. I will preface for everybody, ultimately, none of these really lead anywhere, but I'll talk about them for the sake of the investigation, because this does tie back into that original homicide detective, the 28-year-old Romaine Jenkins. So the first group that we're going to look at are the Green Vega rapists. Now, the Green Vega was a gang that was active in the city at the time, and they were thought to be responsible for quite a few high-profile crimes and quite a number of rapes in the DC area. So they kind of fit the profile, but this was different. This was a group of people. So upon capture of several of the gang members and interviews and interrogations, one of them decided to submit an unsolicited confession. He claimed that the Freeway Phantom was not a singular person, but it was a network of men, all a part of the Green Vega gang. So he asserted that he could prove this by sharing very specific details about the crimes that only the investigators would know. And he could also lead investigators to the exact locations where the bodies were found. So this seemed almost, I mean, because who would take responsibility for something so horrible and heinous? So investigators, right, they were like, could this be true? The Green Vega rapists, they're behind the terror of the Phantom. So they first thought they had a solid lead. And then as he's trying to recount the stories and the details and the locations, it becomes increasingly apparent that this confession was totally a lie. And I think a note that was later retrieved between this suspect to other gang members, he didn't know this was going to be exposed. It basically showed that his confession was him trying to lie and have other people take the fall for being the Freeway Phantom as a means to reduce his own prison sentence, because he would have been solving a crime. But it was completely made up. So that's why I just kind of wanted to turn and burn that really quick, because it's such a dead end that it's not even worth talking about. But I will say the Green Vega gang, they were responsible for other crimes, including rapes, which did come to light by accident, actually, through this confession, because what he was doing, he thought he could talk about the real crimes and rapes that they had committed and say that they were the Phantom, but it didn't align. So when they were like, well, is this credible? Because that was a real crime that happened. How would you know that? It exposed them for all their other crimes.
Well, I guess I'm glad that they got exposed for
exactly, yeah,
the other crimes.
Exactly. So I'm then going to shift into this suspect. This is probably, and still it's kind of open-ended, this is probably the strongest potential suspect that we'll look at. It was March 1977. When a 58-year-old computer technician named Robert Elwood Askins, he was charged with abducting and raping a 24-year-old woman inside his Washington, D.C. home. Now, the homicide detective at the time, this is Lloyd Davis, proceeded to question him and learned that he had been charged with murder several times throughout his life, which I was like, why was this person walking free? Explain that. Several different murders. So he fit the profile, visually, he fit the profile of the Phantom, and he clearly had experience with murder, so this had them take a deeper look into his history, his profile. So in 1938, this guy was 19 years old, and he was a student, and I think he was a member of the science club at Minor Teachers College. He served a cyanide-laced whiskey to five different sex workers at a brothel, which resulted in the death of one of them. It was 31-year-old Ruth McDonald. And then on December 30th, only 2 days after this, he stabbed another sex worker to death. This was 26-year-old Elizabeth Johnson. And this was at the same location, same brothel. He was then arrested. And at the time, Askins declared to police that he was a woman hater. So again, absolutely fit the profile of who we would assume the Phantom to be. He was then placed under mental observation in D.C., and this was at the Gallinger Hospital, I believe. And then by 1952, he must have been released. So he must have gotten out, and then he was released because he strangled 42-year-old Laura Cook to death. He was indicted on this murder in 1954 and accused of several other assaults and similar circumstances. But for some reason, and I could not find the answer to this, no matter how hard I looked, he was acquitted. Or his charge was overturned for some reason. So again, he was free. After the 1978 rape charge, Askins was brought into custody and his home was searched. And this was all in connection of trying to look for clues that he was the Freeway Phantom murderer. Court documents were found in a desk drawer in which a judge had used the word tantamount, a very uncommon word. But it appeared in the note and it was dictated by himself. And this would have been a direct correlation to Brenda Woodard, because she wrote that in her note. Furthermore, there were colleagues at the National Science Foundation where Askins was employed who reported that tantamount was a word that he would frequently use in his speech. Pretty specific word. Not everybody uses that word.
Do you know what's so weird? I'm kicking myself. I almost said that when we were talking about that note.
Saying that tantamount is a specific
that
word.
Tantamount is such a odd, because it kind of reminded me of Zodiac just a little bit. But from what you're saying, totally. His background, he might have been more qualified to actually like be using it in his everyday vernacular, I guess. But the Zodiac would say things that were just sort of trying to demonstrate such an air of, like, you know, being so academic.
Yeah, superiority. And yeah, it's
superiority.
Exactly.
That I almost said something that's so interesting. Okay.
What's interesting is the Zodiac was so, his MO seemed so much more rooted in trying to taunt the press and seek notoriety. The Phantom acknowledged his notoriety, but if you really look at the string of his murders, he didn't seem all too interested in it. He wasn't calling police. He wasn't outing himself. He wasn't calling news networks or, you know, publications. He was just interested in terrorizing the families of his victims.
Right.
Well, while this would be a pretty compelling lead, he's later sentenced for the rape and his other crimes that he had previously committed. There was nothing tangible that was actually found in his apartment to connect him to the bodies of the Freeway Phantom. And he himself has denied that he was the Freeway Phantom. There was no carpet in the car or the home, anything that could match those green fibers. And still, by 1978, DNA testing was not a possibility, so they couldn't connect him back to the hair samples that they still had. But over a decade after the fact, when the Phantom case had basically gone dormant, one person never stopped thinking about it. That was that 28-year-old female homicide detective, like I mentioned before, Romaine Jenkins. She's now in her 40s, and she was a sergeant. She had been heavily promoted. So now she had more sway to actually take another deep dive into this case. So she knew that this guy, Askins, he was in prison, still possibly loosely considered a suspect. But now that DNA, this was like the 90s, was possibly on the table, she thought she could go back into the evidence archives and she would be able to get all the evidence of the Freeway Phantom, retrieve those hairs, and submit them for comparison. What she found was devastating. The evidence file had been marked destroyed, meaning all of the evidence in the case, all hairs, all fibers, all semen samples, everything had been discarded. This is very unusual. I'm going to put that out there. Very unusual, because typically the rule is that if a homicide case is still open, you cannot discard evidence like that. Yet somebody in this case, as wildly high profile as it seemed locally at the time, something as big as the Freeway Phantom, somebody internally made the decision to purge all of that evidence, every single trace of what she thought she could look at to connect the dots here. It was gone. So this has in large part continued to stall the case, I think, even to this day. And just to paraphrase a quote here that I read from her prior to her retirement in the 90s, she mentioned that every single case is like a puzzle. And you have pieces to that puzzle. And if one of those pieces goes missing, there is no way to complete the puzzle. So losing all of the evidence to this case, everything that had accrued through the years, it was essentially tossing the whole puzzle out.
That's devastating. I mean, I was going to say, well, it wasn't a piece. It was the whole damn thing.
Yeah, it's like, starting from scratch.
Oh, my God.
There was I do have something here, though, because it takes a turn. Yeah. There was a singular piece of evidence. One thing that was saved in a separate storage facility. It was a semen sample that was collected from one of the bodies and was still kept. So everybody thought, this is it. Now that we've got DNA, like a DNA database, we can basically submit the sample. We'll see if there's a match to somebody in the database. The sample was so old, they couldn't extract anything from it. Another dead end. Mm. Which is like, I kind of feel like the buck stops there. What more could you do?
And it's such a shame, because the momentum was never really there to begin with, like a momentum and an interest from investigators to begin with.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's just like she's just siloed on her own of like having an interest in it, really, other than I guess if she banded together with, you know, amateur sleuths. But at that point, I mean, it's so much time has gone by.
We've seen other cases that have gone decades without answers and suddenly things happen. But that's usually if there's still evidence available. This is so, I can't like stress this enough how unusual that is to me. And it actually opened up another, you know, conspiracy and possibility here that maybe the MO of discarding the evidence would suggest that it's possibly an inside job. Is it possible that it could be a cop behind the Freeway Phantom murders?
Oh my God. That would be so horrendous.
We have seen things similar to this before, but it's just something like a light bulb went off in my head where I was like, how shocking, I guess, and perplexing that an entire body of officers who didn't want anything to do with this case, didn't want to look into it for so long, let four children basically get murdered before somebody stepped in. They didn't even want to touch the case. But even so, when they got involved, they had nothing to go off of. That almost felt orchestrated in a way. Maybe not knowingly from the larger team, but it's still shocking that they couldn't find anything, and then whatever was left by the time they could crack something had suddenly gone missing.
Well, and this is a really sick thought, but I mean, think about it. If you're a little kid and a cop says, you know, let me give you a ride, that person is safe in your mind.
Absolutely. Well, that goes back to my other thing where I was talking about who would be somebody who could be invisible in plain sight. Somebody where you see them, your instinct is maybe to like look away and be on good behavior and not look closely at what they're doing. It's a cop. I don't know. I mean, there's really nothing to back up what I'm saying other than the oddity of this evidence going missing. I still find that strange, and I don't know where things could have gone wrong with that, who made that decision. But ultimately, this did end up affecting DC law because it was egregious to throw this information out, this valuable evidence that later on, when new technology like DNA profiling was developed, this could have very well have led to a breakthrough. So DC law, I think, enacted something where if a homicide case is open, evidence must be kept in storage for a minimum of 65 years. Probably longer, but the minimum is 65 years. That is the mandate. But Stu, this was the final chapter in the investigation because whoever the Freeway Phantom was, his identity and his whereabouts remained an unknown. Askins, this guy, was really the closest suspect that any of us had, and he would eventually die in prison at the age of 91. And even up until the time of his death, he maintained that he was not the Phantom, and he wouldn't have been able to do that. So that is basically all we have on the story. One final piece here that I will say is that investigators did work at the time, as I alluded to before, to create a bit of a psychological profile of the Phantom. And a lot of this was built upon by Romaine Jenkins herself, where the FBI concluded that some of the obvious details here, he was clearly intelligent. He probably worked in a field that reflected that, which again made Askins a prime suspect because he worked in computers. Outside of the physical known identifier of him being a black male, they felt very, very confident that he was under the age of 40. And the FBI actually believed he could have been in his 20s or at latest his early 30s, which was disturbing to me because his first kill was in 1971. So if this profile is to be believed, that could mean that as of today, he's possibly as old as maybe 88 and as young as 74. So he could very much still be alive, and it is even possible he is still in the DC area.
Well, you know, I'm going to be on the frickin' hunt. I'm going to be like looking around at every car I see. I swear if I'm over in that area, I don't know.
It's just that weird feeling of like something's just a little too close to home kind of thing. But that, I mean, I think when I hear cases from the 70s, the odd comfort in the back of my mind is knowing that mostly anyone who was involved in a nefarious way is probably dead. That's not the case. You hear that cop in the background?
I do.
Pipey. Well, one conclusive psychological point here that the FBI also felt was clear is that this was absolutely a textbook psychopath, typically categorized but not exclusive to a severe deficit of guilt or remorse, no empathy for others, very, very limited and mild emotional range. But psychopaths, as I said before, can also present with surface-level charm and socially manipulative tactics to lure people into things. They think that this was probably evident because it was more than likely that he had gotten at least one, if not several, of the girls in his car willingly. So they must have perceived him as non-threatening, like you said before, and he probably offered them a ride home. They also believe that this particular psychopath presented with a need for stimulation, severe stimulation, and he sought extreme acts to appease himself, as well as sexual harm that he inflicted upon others. But despite all of this that is known by the FBI, everything we have covered in this story with these six victims, That is all that is known, and the case today remains unsolved.
Can I just say, that was such thorough research.
Thank you.
I feel like I know so much about it. Like, I mean, maybe it's also just my own feeling of being close to it, proximity-wise, but I just feel like you really gave me such a comprehensive look at that time and everybody that was affected by it.
Isn't it crazy that this is so seldomly discussed? Isn't that?
Yeah, I can't believe I've never heard of it, even like in my time of living here. I mean,
let me see if I can send you some pictures. Hold on, because I know we kind of skipped pictures through this whole thing because the train was very much moving. Let's see.
Yeah.
The Freeway Phantom.
It's just really sick to think that like this person could be sitting in like the Northern Virginia or like Maryland area, just like still alive. I can't imagine they live possible. In the city.
Entirely possible. Here, let me drop this link to you. So this is a picture of the six victims that he claimed that we know, because he did allude to there being more girls that the police did not know about.
Sweet girls. Oh my God.
I may have other pictures here because I did a collection. I have a picture of the note that I can send you. Hold on. And again, this was written in Brenda's hand, not his.
Okay. I also was thinking to myself, like, what if he used to live in that neighborhood, like when he first started out? And then when everything was like then he moved out of the neighborhood.
Mm. I think that seemed clear. I mean, I don't know. It's really difficult to say, actually. Let me see if I can send you a map of where all the bodies were found. Because that was kind of, you know, DC, I will say, you know, DC much better than I do. But that was kind of spelling a story for me. I was like, well, if this is where he's dumping the bodies, the only thing I could imagine is that as soon as he does that, he immediately wants to go home and shower, like clean himself. That's a really common thing that you start to see with a lot of serial killers is that the second that they're done with the act and the high wears off, they go and they try to cleanse themselves from what they just did. So I would imagine that wherever he's dumping these bodies, it's then fairly close to his home. Let me send you this map. I could be completely off. That's my own interpretation.
Oh God. You know what I hate so much from these notes that get left behind? The exclamation points. Like, I will admit the others when you catch me, if you can, exclamation point. It's just so unnerving.
Well, he must have dictated that to her, which is crazy. Like, even down to the punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
But you see what I'm saying, though? Like, it does look like it was written by somebody who was calm, we could say. How scary. Could you imagine the fear she must have felt, though? My insensitivity to people, especially women. And she's the one who's tasked to pen this.
Wow, these are actually very far apart from each other.
Are they? I couldn't tell. But
you see what I mean, though? They're all kind of right there on that like perimeter. They don't call it like the belt line, but they like, there's a term for this, where that whole section where it's kind of like Brenda and then Carol and Darlene, yeah, are kind of right there. Off of an exit, almost.
I do see it, yeah.
It just makes me think that he lived somewhere along that.
Do you think he lived on the eastern side of this picture?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, for sure.
I'm wrestling in my mind with the idea. I'm like, okay, well, is this a sign of where he actually lives and where he wants to get home too quickly? Or is this a sign that he's trying to deliberately put these bodies, what looks like on the other side of the water, because he's on the other side. And that puts a bit of distance between him and what he's done, his connection to what he's done.
Maybe.
I don't know. No.
It's so weird. I'm sorry, and not to make this about me, obviously. It's so weird to see this map and see where I live. It's just like in proximity to this and all of his, where he struck. Ugh.
It's things like that you don't really think about, especially when you're driving through a major city. Like, I think I actively avoid information like that because I think it would terrify me. If I knew, like, where the Night Stalker, for example, like, struck all the homes that he invaded, that would be horrifying to me.
Yeah.
Let's do. That is absolutely everything I have got. I think it's insane that more people don't know about this case. And I don't know how we... For a second, I wanted to say that somebody suggested it, but I don't think anyone did. I really do think that I stumbled across this when we were like looking for DC cases. And I was like, I'd never heard of the Freeway Phantom. I'm happy that this was investigated by people and it brought more light to the story, but I'm more satisfied now to know that more people know the names of these six girls.
Mm-hmm.
And whether this can lead to something down the line, I truly don't know because so much evidence has been lost or discarded. But I hope for the best.
Absolutely. And if their families are still in the DC area, I wish to God, like, this could resurface at some point because these families never got closure.
Never. I think they later on went to, I mean, of course, there's camaraderie in pain. And I think a lot of these families that were left in like ruins, they bonded with other families who were also victims
mm-hmm.
of the Freeway Phantom because it was the connecting through line. But the unresolved pain, I think, of just being abandoned by the police, the people who were trusted to protect you, who allowed this to go on for over a year, even up to the FBI, and solely because this was mostly just a disenfranchised community, these were young Black girls, I think this would have been a very, very different story. If these were young white children who had been murdered, this would have been national news, and this probably would have been solved a lot sooner. And I think the Phantom knew this, and I think he used it to his advantage to continue to remain elusive.
Ugh. Ooh, I'm going to walk around a little differently.
I was going to say, I was like, let's take a break. Let's resolve. Thank you for listening to that because that was, I know that was a darker and heavier case than we usually get into, Creepers. I'm so sorry.
Honestly, though, when I said like your research was so comprehensive, like it is really educational to remember that there were, I know we've covered so many 70s serial killers, but they've been more like high profile. This is kind of an unknown case that I think has been unknown for reasons that aren't right.
And it's
historic. Really glad you brought it to light. Yeah, it's historic.
It's thank you for saying that. Thank you for talking about the research. I mean, it's not easy to get through, but I really wanted to do justice to at least trying to understand some of the historical context of why something like this could have happened and why it fell under the radar. And also, I'm trying to earn us our history badge on Spotify.
Exactly.
We are categorized.
Did we lose it?
No.
Okay. Did you imagine? It's like, we might have lost it by now.
They're like, so we saw that you did The Conjuring Haunting and you're labeled as a history podcast.
Like, some Spotify exec accidentally went to Creep Time After Dark and was like, this is nowhere in the realm of history other than their own.
Creep Time After Dark only got labeled as comedy. They wouldn't give us truth. Okay. They gave us nothing else. I was like, what about society and commentary? They were like, clowns. You're clowns. Like,
yeah. Comedy and mental illness.
Just stop. Well, on that note, I think we can probably wrap up this episode of Creep Time, the podcast. Thank you again, everybody, for listening. And as always, we're going to say goodbye.
And good luck, creepers.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.